Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this show, I share strategies and ideas. I tell stories. I share some of my big epic fails I've made along the way, and I interview people. And one of the people that I'm interviewing is someone today, and I'm super excited. This interview is actually a few months old, but I feel like right now is sort of the right time to air it. So I'm going to be sharing this interview, and the person that I am interviewing is Dr. Mattson. Dr. Kristen Mattson is a former English teacher and school librarian, currently serving as an educational consultant and adjunct professor at the University of Illinois. Her latest book, Ethics in a Digital World, challenges teachers and students to explore the gray areas at the intersection of technology and humanity. Kristen lives in the suburbs of Chicago with her husband, three kids, and her fur baby, which is something I also have in common with her. You have probably heard the dogs in the background of my podcast at different times. But I'm super excited about this interview. She is a true expert on digital citizenship and digital ethics. She has a fascinating perspective on this. And I loved getting a chance to do this interview. And I think you're going to love it. So without further ado, here we go. Here is Dr. Kristen Mattson. All right, I have Dr. Kristen Mattson here, and she's going to be talking about the big idea of digital ethics. And I think with that, we'll probably get into some ideas around media literacy, digital citizenship, just how to navigate the larger digital terrain, I think is something a lot of people think about. I would love for you, as we get started, to hear, how did you get interested in this particular topic?
Well, that's a long but kind of interesting to me story. So I have a history as an English teacher and a high school librarian. And I would say close to 2011 or so, my district pulled all of the librarians together in the district. There were about 32 of us. And said, you know, we have to teach internet safety. We have to teach this digital citizenship thing. Legally, we have to. And we just don't really know what that should look like in our district. So we were given a charge to do a little bit of research, see what existed kind of out there on the internet, try some lessons with our kids. And we were going to reconvene at a later date to kind of talk about what internet safety education or digital citizenship education could look like in our district. And so as I started kind of Googling around and looking for these pieces, I got incredibly frustrated because all of the things that I found really talked about students and the internet in really, really different ways. And I thought, you know, if there's not even consensus around this term digital citizenship, how in the world are we supposed to pick a direction for our district to go? Because it feels like no one has even really figured out what this squishy term really means yet. And so at the time I was entering my doctoral program in curriculum and instruction, and there was something about this digital citizenship thing that just kind of kept gnawing at me. It bothered me that there wasn't a strong definition. It bothered me that most of the things that I saw that were out there seemed very preachy and kind of hell-bent on punishing kids or embarrassing kids or frightening kids. And I just thought to myself, like, there has to be a better way to do this. And so my doctoral work basically looked at 65 different curricular pieces that were just kind of freely out there for me to find on the internet. And I looked through all of these curriculum, just trying to find some patterns. What were things that these curriculum were saying about what we should be teaching kids regarding technology in the classroom? Was there any really research on like best practices for how to teach some of these skills? And I had a really hard time finding a dissertation chair because a lot of people said to me, Kristen, there's not enough out there. I don't know how you're even going to write a literature review when there's not enough literature. And I'm stubborn enough that I said, hey, if I can't find anything to read, clearly there's a gap here that needs to be studied. My work was really just about trying to figure out the conversation around digital citizenship, mostly at the secondary level at that point in time, which was about 2015. And, you know, by and large, I found that it was mostly a curriculum of control. And it really was an attempt, I think, for adults to try to really kind of be in control of these changes that we were seeing in education, changes that we were seeing in society, more kids having more access to devices and information. And it felt scary, I think, for a little while, because teachers weren't the end-all be-all deliverers of knowledge anymore. Knowledge was kind of everywhere. And that conversation of control really, really came through when looking at the lessons that people were doing in their classrooms. And so my work ended up being just kind of a response to that. I really have always felt strongly that we need to empower kids with skills and with knowledge and education to make really good decisions for themselves. And that was where I kind of got my start. And my first book, Digital Citizenship in Action, was basically just a whole bunch of recommendations to try to shift the conversation away from protection and control to, you know, let's engage some kids with some skills and let's try to empower them and give them safe spaces to practice being online together. And I'm happy that that is no longer like some mind-blowing revolutionary idea. I think people are starting to feel the same way that I do about digital citizenship. But back in, you know, 2014, 2015, when I was doing my research, that was not the conversation. So I'm happy to see it starting to shift.
I remember years ago, speaking of that, I did a training on digital citizenship. And I remember I began the conversation by saying, you know, what are the components of citizenship? Like, take digital out of it, right? And and it was like, we want independent thinkers, we want democracy, we want discussion, we want you to be knowledgeable about what's going on in the world, this and that. And then we just deconstructed, we did a Google image search and we just deconstructed visuals of digital citizenship. And it's like, it was exactly that. It was control. It was like telling you what not to do and lockdown and how dangerous everything is. And I remember somebody said, like, they said the way digital citizenship is being taught to kids is the way that Say No to Drugs was taught to us in the 80s. And he's like, it kind of makes you want to light up a joint, right? Yeah. Like, it kind of, and I was like, oh, well, maybe no. Like, let's stay back. This is school. But, you know, it was this, like, very much, there wasn't any opportunity to digital citizenship. There was no concept of, like, we're going to be proactive or we're going to be empowered or what's the goal.
When we think about kind of where we were situated culturally at the time as well, I'm a huge Dateline fan. I probably watched more Dateline than I should admit, but maybe you remember Dateline's To Catch a Predator and how, you know, there was this whole entertainment industry around, you know, catching the creepy guy in the basement talking to young kids on the internet. And the first money that was really actually put toward internet education for students in the United States was funneled through the Department for Justice. And the curriculum came from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And so when we think about the goals of the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children, and that organization was the only one that was getting government funds to start to develop educational materials, it kind of makes you go, oh, okay, now I get it. I see why we were where we were. But the conversation is shifting, which is really, really exciting for me. I listened to you talk with Austin Kleon on your podcast. I don't know what day that was, a couple weeks ago, maybe.
Yeah.
And You were talking about how gross you thought the conversation of digital branding was. And how
Oh my gosh.
Yes. And I was in my car listening and I was nodding my head like, I like this guy. He says the things I say. Because I think we had a pendulum swing there for a little bit where people were really tired of talking about the dangers of the internet. And so they were like, well, let's teach people about the opportunities of the internet and let's teach kids how to build a brand for themselves. That always sat kind of gross with me too. And I think, you know, I think because it is just so, it is so capitalistic and it is still so individual. It doesn't really talk about the benefits of the internet to build community or to collaborate or, you know, to create interesting things together. If I'm building a brand, it still really is all about a look at me sort of a thing. And the beauty of the internet is that it doesn't have to just be about me all the time. I can find other people to be in community with.
And there's also that, like, you know, all the research coming out on the sort of like fear of missing out, right? And that's often presented as like, well, there's this fear of missing out and this is the problem with social media. But we also have a generation raised on social media with a put your best foot forward kind of, you know, vulnerability gets exploited. It's bad to stay away. So it feels like there's this weird aspect of like, oh, well, of course, the fear of missing out is going to be, I'm not saying caused by it, but there's going to be some association there between fear of missing out and this branding, put your best foot forward, always show the best of what's going on. I would love, what we're going to get into the topic of digital ethics here in a second, because I want to say I loved your book.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to be recommending it to students. I teach our tech class at the university I'm just like, this is a great book. But I would love for a moment, what do you see as kind of the goal or the goals of digital citizenship?
So I have a colleague, Leanne Lindsay. I cited her in my dissertation, and we've been doing some collaborative work together around digital citizenship. And she and I have kind of been wrestling with some type of graphic or framework or something that people can grab onto, because I think we hear digital citizenship, media literacy, technology literacy, 21st century skills. We hear all these buzzwords. And I think for somebody who's not immersed in the work, it's easy to look at all of these things and say, well, aren't these all just saying the same thing? Or how might, even if they're not saying the same thing, how in the world do I fit all of this into my day as a classroom teacher when I'm still having to teach traditional skills? And so for me, digital citizenship is sort of like the pinnacle. It's the end goal. Before we started recording, you and I were chatting about just the goal of schooling early on was to create citizens who could be active members of their communities, who understood the democratic processes and who could participate in these things. And, you know, we never really had a class in school that was like how to be a citizen. It was the culmination of all of our experiences in school that led us to being a full participatory citizen in a culture. So for me, digital citizen is sort of like the goal. It's the end game. It's what we're aiming to develop. But we're having to rethink some of the skills that we are equipping students with in order for them to get there. So traditional literacy is still super important, but it can't be where we stop. Because in order for me to participate fully as a citizen of a digital space, I also have to have some media literacy and some news literacy. I have to know how to interact and communicate and collaborate, not just with people in my classroom, but with people through a screen. And so it's going deeper, I think. And it's, you know, it's not a replacement of what we've taught in school, but it might be a little bit of a pivot and definitely a deepening of skills that you and I definitely didn't learn in school.
Yeah. What do you think are some of the skills that are necessary that are maybe missing from the current school system when it comes to this.
Yeah, I think right now there's really great stuff happening in pockets around the country. Mm-hmm. There are people from the News Literacy Project and the Stanford History Education Group who are putting out amazing work on, you know, news literacy and civic online reasoning and how do we do these things in digital spaces. But the ways in which those skills are being taught really depend on if you have a teacher who's excited about the topic, if you have a teacher who's mm-hmm. knowledgeable about the topic, and can figure out how to kind of hack those things into whatever their content area might be. School librarians are an amazing source of skills like information literacy and technology troubleshooting. But we've seen school librarian positions across the country, you know, being cut and replaced. And so, you know, for me, it's always this question of, do we need just a complete reset? Do we need to take a step back and say, what are some things that we can let go of in our curriculum? And what are some things that maybe need to be reprioritized? And I think just having those skills to be critical thinkers about the technology we use, the technology that we create, all the different forms of media that we come across, whether that's a meme or a podcast or a book, right? And then
don't you feel like
go ahead.
I mean, I'll just camp out in meme for a second. I feel like you could spend an hour with, say, I'll give middle literacy. Schoolers for example. Yeah, we could spend an hour deconstructing memes with middle schoolers,
totally,
to teach filter bubbles, to teach algorithms, to teach what goes viral, to deconstruct it with different lenses, right? A critical lens here, you know, looking at what's actually being said, what's missing from it. I just think it becomes a fascinating thing that could be looked at, and yet I feel like there is still this sort of idea of like it would be a waste of time to focus on memes because we need to teach what real literature, right? And I just feel like
some of this media that our students come across every day is a really nice entry point to teaching some of these higher level skills that we want them to have anyway. We want them to be critical thinkers. We want them to be able to analyze the things that are in front of them. And that can be really hard with a complex text, with a primary source document that I don't have any background knowledge about. But I can start to introduce and practice and model and scaffold these skills with media that my students are really used to seeing, whether that's a meme or song lyric or whatever that might be. What's really fascinating is when you can put collections of media together. One of my favorite media literacy people is Frank Baker, and he's actually curated up magazine covers that have come out during the pandemic on his website. He's got like 150 magazine covers. And what's crazy is like, you can look at one magazine cover and say, okay, like look at the red, right? Red makes us feel like there's, you know, a danger here, or we need to stop. And look at the fonts that are used. This is the same font that we see on like a cigarette package warning label. And look at the spikes on the COVID ball. You know, it feels like a porcupine, like I need to stay away from it. What's really crazy though is when you look at the collection of 100 magazine covers and how we see those exact same techniques being used again and again and again and again to tell this story of like, what is COVID-19? And so pieces of media in isolation are really cool to teach the skills. But I think when students can see patterns across media and can see how the media that they're in every day really starts to forward cultural ideas, starts to forward truths about different groups in society or about different topics. One really fun analysis I did with students last year was to look at 23 newspaper headlines the day after Kobe Bryant's death. And we really looked at like what sorts of words were used to talk about Kobe Bryant across these 23 newspapers, and how is he going to be remembered based on the ways he was portrayed in the media after his death. And so I do think that students are eager to have these conversations when we're bringing them content that's relevant to them and familiar to them. And then, of course, once we build those skills in small ways, they're more prepared to do that kind of heavy lifting with content that maybe is outside of their comfort zone.
So one of the things that I think about is I want to get to digital ethics here in a moment.
Yeah.
I love digital citizenship, how you're thinking about it. I love the fact that it's not just be safe, right? Because that one of the things that we, you know, I used to teach students, I taught history. We talked about the dialogue between what's more important for society, freedom or safety, and the wrestling balance between those. And citizenship is so much about both, right?
Yes.
And yet, once it moved into digital, it was nearly always be safe, be safe, be safe, be safe. Never, what are you advocating for? How are you breaking down, how are you breaking down barriers? Like, how are you defining justice? And it just was interesting to see justice, freedom, injustice, any of those things, they were never a part of the conversation for digital citizenship. Digital citizenship conversations were almost always centered on be safe.
And almost always centered on you as an individual, right? So, and
absolutely.
And what's interesting is like the dangers were never, the dangers were always like you making a mistake. You talked to a stranger. You posted something that you shouldn't have. You gave out personal information. And so like you were the danger to yourself. And even now, one of my favorite pieces to have my graduate students read is an opinion piece from the New York Times. The title is something like, Google is teaching kids how to be safe online, but are they the best role model? That's close. If you Google it, you'll find it. But their biggest critique is that Google's internet safety curriculum never talks about how students' data is being collected, stored, utilized, and sold by companies like Google. And so again, the companies themselves are never sort of the problem or the thing to look out for. We're never supposed to question the structures. It's always supposed to be a question of like our own personal behaviors, which is problematic for me too. So it's funny you mentioned it's funny you mentioned privacy versus safety, because there's a chapter in the new book, the digital ethics book, that is all about privacy and how much privacy are we willing to give up in this digital age. One of my good friends, Adam Deitch, is a social studies department chair, high school social studies department chair, and he's great about wanting to take things he's traditionally taught and putting a new spin on them or looking at them through a new lens. And so when you said privacy versus security, it reminded me of a unit that we did with his students where instead of looking at some of the traditional examples that he always talked about with kids, like should the principal be able to search your locker?
Yeah.
It's your private space, right? We really just changed the dialogue and started asking kids questions like, you know, should college recruiters be allowed to dig through your social media profiles? Should the government be able to access data from the Alexa that's in your home if it thinks you have committed a crime? Because what we might think of as maybe ethically not okay isn't necessarily illegal. And what we might be kind of weary about would be okay under the law. And so just really getting kids to think about how some of these classic Supreme Court cases function now in a digital society and getting them to question whether the law has kind of caught up to where we are. And getting them to pontificate, like, you know, how the law might change moving forward. There was so much more buy-in with that conversation. Kids were super geeked out about it.
One of the things that I'm struck by as you describe that is critiquing the companies themselves, critiquing the way the system works itself. You know, I taught digital journalism my final 3 years in the classroom, and I really... One of the beliefs I have is if you want to understand how something works, being creative in that space is one of the best ways to get there, right? Like I can appreciate theater, but I don't appreciate theater as well as someone who even was in a high school theater production, right? Like they understand it better. Or I enjoy sports, but my kids already know more about, like my sons are really into baseball. They know more about baseball because they pitch and you learn things about it. And so I always felt like journalism was a way to teach digital citizenship, media literacy, digital ethics in a way that was integrated with a curriculum, you know, language arts.
Yeah.
With this focus on deeper citizenship that went beyond just, hey, this is a separate thing that you're doing, right? There was something participatory where you would then make sense out of, you know, critiquing the platforms that you're actually using, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
if we're putting things on social media, let's critique the platform. And one of the things that I remember is so many students would say something like, I just want to be social in this space. I don't even think about politics. That would be a great example.
Yeah.
But then I would watch them on, you know, Instagram, Snapchat, whatever it was, and they flip through these things, and all the time that they're skipping political content and not thinking about it, they're being shaped by those headlines that they're not taking a deep dive into.
Yep.
And it would be like, actually, I'd rather you in a certain way be political than not political, because choosing not to be political is a passive reactive way, right?
For sure.
And so as I think about this, one of the questions I have is, how do you help the student who says, look, I just use this socially. It's not a big deal to me. I know how to be safe. I won't send in inappropriate pictures. I don't give my password away, which seems to be a lot of Gen Z students. What do you say to that kid in particular about the bigger definition of digital citizenship and digital ethics?
Yeah, I think for me, it's getting kids to critique beyond themselves, because even as, you know, I'm in a few social media spaces, but I'm definitely not in every single social media space. And yet I think we can see ways that social media spaces have shaped our culture, the ways that they have shaped our politics, even the ways that they've shaped some of the response to this pandemic, right? And so even if this is not something that I'm personally invested in or personally taking a whole lot of time to care about, it does inadvertently impact me that so much of the world is consumed in these spaces and utilizing these spaces. I kind of think about it from two lenses. I want my students to be informed so that they can make decisions that are good for them. I think about abstinence-only sex education comes to mind when I start to talk about these topics. Because with abstinence-only sex ed, we were given a way to be safe, right? Like, don't look at people of the other gender, don't talk to them, you'll be just fine. But we didn't really empower students with any types of skills or mindsets should they choose a different path. And so, you know, we've seen with comprehensive sex education, the teen pregnancy rate has gone down, students and people are more open to talking about sexuality. And so I think some of that is the same with tech. You know, I've got a 10, a 12, and a 14-year-old, and they are all involved in social media and the internet in different ways and different platforms. And we definitely have some rules in our household. But my husband and I very much know the why behind the rules. And we make sure that our kids know the why behind the rules as well. And when we start to open up and allow them to move into different spaces, there's always a conversation about, you know, here's the pros, here's the cons, here are things you can do if you run into problems, here are things that you should do when you have questions. Because eventually our kids are going to enter these spaces if they're not there already. And I'd really rather them just kind of know the full picture so that they can make smart choices for themselves. Yeah, I don't even remember what we started talking about, John.
No, it's Sorry. Great. No, it's awesome. I was, you know, the reference there was the idea of, you know, what do you say to the kid who says, like, I'm just being social here. What's the big deal? It's, you know, and I love that you're getting to the heart of, let's think more intentionally about this.
Well, yeah. And I think moving again beyond yourself and thinking about, how is this impacting us as a whole, as a society? Because even if I choose not to be a part, some of these things are going to impact me directly at some point, because they don't just live online. They influence
absolutely
the offline world as well. So,
I'm going to talk for a moment now about this idea of digital ethics. And what I love is just how broad and expansive the book is in terms of digital ethics. When I saw hey, do you want to check out this book? I was initially skeptical because I've seen so much around ethics that are very black and white, mm-hmm. and very right and wrong, and very... but what struck me about this was all of the different areas of ethics to think about, including thinking about the nature of technology itself and how it's changing society, which I think never gets enough attention.
Yep.
The systems behind it, the sheer level of systems thinking, and the way you really seem to frame it, not on this is right and wrong, but more on how do we have those vital dialogues around these different ideas. So what I would love for you to talk about is I know it's like, just tell me all about your book, but when we think about digital ethics, what are a few key areas that I think teachers, or that you think teachers need to think about around digital ethics?
Yeah, I like that you mentioned like the it's not black and white piece, because I do think that is a space that I sit in this topic that is maybe a little bit different. One of my favorite... I wrote a tweet, I don't know, 3 years ago, and I still really love it. And I don't know where the words came from, but they came to me and I spit them out and I still use them. It was like, you know, digital ethics is really what we need to be exploring at the intersection of technology and humanity. It's these tensions that exist when we start to think about how technology influences us as human beings. And for me, like, it's recognizing that the value systems that I have, that I was brought up with, that I instill in my own children, are not necessarily the same value systems that you might instill in your kids, John, or that, you know, parents mm-hmm. who are raising kids in different socioeconomic statuses or from different cultural backgrounds. Like, value systems aren't necessarily 100% set in stone. And so just like when we talk about, you know, empowering kids with knowledge so that they can make good decisions, I want them to be able to think through these topics and come away with answers that align with the value systems that that are important to them. And I mm-hmm. want them to be able to make sense for themselves of sort of how all of these different topics work and function in their lives and in the lives of their friends. So I want to tell you, I guess, where the idea from this book came from. I had been doing a lot of reading. I don't even know why, because I'm a reader and I read stuff. I came across the work of Sophia Nobel, her book, Algorithms of Oppression. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It was eye-opening to me. And the book is a few years old. I believe the research was done around 2015, where she was kind of looking at Google search and the ways that pretty traditional biases were showing up in Google search results. And so one of the examples from the book that I just kind of remember was a Google image search for the word doctor, and how the first page of results that came back were all like white men in doctor's coats. And it mm-hmm. wasn't until the second page of the Google image results that we started to see females or doctors of color. And mm-hmm. so she, you know, goes through a lot of examples like this of the ways that, you know, Google search was kind of reinforcing some of our stereotypes as a society. And so I thought, wow, I guess technology isn't very neutral, which is what I had been telling teachers for a long time, right? Like, technology is not a magic bullet. Technology is neutral. It all depends on what you do with it that makes it amazing in the classroom. And her work really made me stop and go, wait a minute. No, technology isn't neutral, because there are people that are creating and developing these products, and human beings themselves aren't neutral, and we're the ones creating these things. And so from her work, I just kind of started reading things that she had cited, and I picked up other books along the way. And, you know, I thought to myself, nobody's having these conversations in K-12. In K-12, we are pushing STEM education pretty hardcore, right? Like, we want our students to have access to coding skills. I'm seeing a lot of high schools offering industry certifications in tech fields. A lot of libraries are starting to pivot into makerspaces, and we're talking about design thinking and computational thinking, all really super important things, but at the expense of what? Right. And as a person who has always been a humanities person, I think part of my hang up was like, well, where do my skills fit into all of this stuff? Right. I don't code. I mean, I can do some math, but it's not my favorite. I'm pretty decent with technology, but I have no desire to create new apps or create new products. And so I really started questioning, like, where do the humanities fit? As our society continues to move more and more down this path of being technology driven, and what kind of messages are we sending to our students who are, you know, who like to think and work through problems and talk about the philosophical sides and the sociological impacts. And I came across the work of David Ryan Polgar, who wrote the introduction for the book. And he is he's a tech ethicist. And I was like, huh, tech ethicist. I didn't know that was a thing. And through his work, I've really been introduced to a whole world of people who are working in, you know, algorithmic justice, who are working in anti-bias work in AI. He's doing a lot of work on trying to build some pipelines between colleges and companies who are looking for tech ethicists. It was not a major. That was an option 5 or 6 years ago. And so for me, I felt like, you know, when I started to read this work and I started to dig into these topics, I saw myself in them. And I thought, how many students that are like me that, you know, think technology is pretty cool, but really care a lot about human beings and care a lot about society and you know, really love the humanities, there is a place for me in this work. And I really just thought that with our push for STEM, it was important to highlight and talk about the humanities and where the humanities fit into this bigger picture. And so the book is really designed around several big kind of overarching questions, things like can algorithms erase human bias? And within that chapter, I talk about a couple of different arguments that are being made today about the relationships between bias and algorithms. And I go through what leading experts are saying on all sides of this argument. And then I talk about some sort of in the headlines stories that are happening today. And then I give teachers some really practical ways that they can bring that conversation into the classroom. Throughout the book, there's also spotlights of classroom teachers who are already doing some of this work with students. And I wanted to highlight them and shout them out and let people know that it is possible to have these higher level conversations with middle school and high school kids, because there are people that are already doing it. So yeah, each chapter is just a look at a big ethical dilemma, a big ethical question, and it's really meant to give the teacher some background knowledge around that question and give them some practical things that they can bring into the classroom to have that conversation with kids.
And that's one of the things I loved about it, I just say, is how engaging it was written, right? So clearly you are highly knowledgeable. You have a doctorate in this, you're steeped in this work, but it is, and it's also very practical, but I just was struck by, like, oh, this is a fun read. Like, this is a really, like, it was fun to read. And I think that in terms of professional reading sometimes is ignored, but I think it's really important to say, like, professional reading can be really enjoyable. And I was struck by that piece.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
No problem. You know, one of the things I think about as you talk about the algorithms and the ethics is how often technology moved forward missing huge aspects of the humanities, right? So philosophy is now suddenly really important as we think about self-driving cars, right? The trolley problem is literally happening for us, right? And so I just want to be like every tech person has to watch The Good Place and get into moral philosophy, because that's gonna matter.
And you know what, my sixth grade daughter has a teacher who's an ed tech specialist, and he actually brought the trolley problem into class.
Oh my gosh, I love it.
Self-driving car. My sixth grader came home and was telling me all about it, and she had very intelligent things to say about the topic.
Guess what? Love.
She's not coding. She's not programming. She's not self-driving for sure. She's only 12, but she had important things to say about that topic. So it's doable. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Or I think about, you know, you brought up, you know, algorithms and the biases within that, you know, in AI, one of the huge things they're reckoning with is so much of the AI right now is built on the essential source code, which was all of the Enron emails, right?
Oh,
which were largely white males in Texas, reinforcing a lot of social biases. And they're going, wait a second, these biases are now being accidentally embedded into artificial intelligence and machine learning. How do you unlearn the biases that are now built into these systems? I mean, wow, you know, things like that I think are sometimes missing from the conversation, mm-hmm. that become really important. Even, you know, I did teach coding. So, I mean, I taught half the day taught journalism, half the day taught STEM.
Nice.
But a great example of that was we did Scratch video game projects. And I remember sending an email to Scratch, to the MIT folks, saying, I know that what you want is to gather data on how many boys and girls are coding, but what is it saying that you're reminding somebody of gender right before they code? Mm-hmm. Is there a hidden cost to that? And I've got a student who's transgender, and now I'm having a whole different conversation signing them up for it.
Yeah.
And that bias is, again, built into it. And so the beautiful side of it is then, without it being centered on the transgender issue, I immediately retooled the Scratch video game project to get into what are the biases of video game. Let's think about video games, gamer culture. We bring in the lens of gender. We bring in the lens of race. We bring in the whole thing of like, when you picture a gamer, what pops into your head?
Yep.
I love it.
Yep.
And I just felt like that's so necessary in STEM. And so what I would love to hear from you is, first at the secondary level, and then maybe at the elementary as well, I want to think about this. Too often it seems like digital citizenship, media literacy, and digital ethics, those three topics are almost always taught separately, mm-hmm. or it becomes another thing to add to your plate if you're teaching self-contained.
Yep.
So what I would love to know is what advice would you give to teachers who want to incorporate digital citizenship and digital ethics into, say, a high school math or science or technology class?
Yeah. So as a high school librarian, I never got my own group of kids. I literally had to convince teachers to work with me if I wanted a group of kids to try anything out with, and if I wanted to forward any of the skills that I cared about. And so mm-hmm. I got really, really good at doing something that I call in my first book, hacking the standards. And I now teach, people who are going into like ed tech coaching roles and school librarian roles. And we talk about how important it is to build those instructional partnerships. But the way that I've found to do it is really to look at, you know, what are the skills that I care about, whether that's a critical thinking skill, some type of media analysis skill, and then how can I teach that skill using the content that the teacher cares about? So again, going back to that story of Adam in the social studies class, I really wanted students to start, you know, thinking about and picking apart the ways that law had or had not caught up with technology. And he really cared about covering this unit on privacy versus security. And so through those two things, kind of, it's like app smashing, right? You've got to like smash them together and find a way for it to work. He and I also built a really great Socratic seminar around the question of whether or not Slacktivism or online activism was as impactful as actual activism. And so he already had a unit on activism and what it looked like to be engaged as a citizen. And so all we did was kind of hack it and twist it a little bit to add this layer of technology to it. I worked with a health teacher a few years ago who had an existing unit on healthy relationships. And because there hadn't been a curriculum renewal in some time, that healthy relationships unit never, ever touched on aspects of technology. And if you have 15-year-olds in a classroom and you're talking about relationships and you're not talking at all about texting and social media and digital drama, like, you're missing the boat. And so for me, it was looking for these opportunities where things already had a natural fit and approaching teachers and saying to them, hey, can I help you make this over? Can I help you update this unit? Can I help you take this unit a little bit deeper or a little bit left of center maybe than we were doing it before? I've been having some conversations with folks about this crazy desire I have. It's on my bucket list to develop some units of digital citizenship through dystopian literature.
I love it.
It is just like ripe for the building. It's a question of like when I'm going to get to that thing on my to-do list. But you know, as a former English teacher, teaching Ray Bradbury short stories, and I mean, how different those units would look like now compared to what they looked like 15 years ago when I was teaching them. I think there's so many opportunities to weave those topics in. With elementary school students, you know, we are doing makerspaces in school libraries. We are having Hour of Code. I think the example that you gave was great, just kind of helping kids think about what is a quote unquote gamer, who can be a coder. You know, how can we take something that we're building in the makerspace and think about it as a way to solve a social problem that we have, as opposed to just creating for the sake of creating. It really is just about looking for opportunities where you can see connections. And I recognize that that's hard for a busy teacher. I really do. But I do think that there are lots of creative people out there as well. And so I'd encourage anybody that's listening that has creative ideas to share them so that other people can start to see them too.
My final question for you, and I really appreciate just all that I'm getting here, hearing about it, thinking about it, is when we think about something like this idea of digital ethics, and I'll add digital citizenship to it, because I think those two are so closely tied together. To what extent do you think it's a skill that students need to learn versus a mindset or a habit or even something that someone attaches to their identity or attitudes or beliefs? Like,
can I say all of the above?
All of the, they can definitely be all of the above. I definitely feel like these things are often focused on and taught as skills that need to be mastered, right? Even thinking like I aligned everything to the ISTE standards, and even the wording of the ISTE standards, as great as they are, tend to have a sort of embedded assumption of students mastering skills. And so you're saying they're all of the above, and do you want to explain it? And then also does it look like for teachers to develop all of the above?
Yeah. So I think in order to be a digital citizen, to basically have access to these wonderful digital communities that we're all part of. There are some skills, right, that I have to have. I have to have some basic technological literacies. I need to know how to set up accounts and operate devices and do some basic troubleshooting when things don't go well. Those are definitely teachable, measurable skills. But I think we do things in school like SEL that's really squishy and can't be measured on a standardized test, right? And we want our kids to have good, you know, problem solving skills. We want them to be able to recognize their own emotions. We want them to get along with others. And those are things that we don't throw by the wayside because we can't measure them. But they are still important within our schools. And they're things that we kind of, they're everywhere and nowhere, which is sort of how some of this is. And so it's mindsets of, I think, being open to new ideas, being a lifelong learner. I'm hungry. Like I know I'm barely scratching the surface of some of these things. And so every time I have an opportunity to connect with others and collaborate with others, I've already written down a whole bunch of stuff that I'm going to go look up when you and I get off for this call. And so, you know, it is some skill sets of being able to just intelligently navigate all the stuff that's out there. But it's also this mindset that I'm never going to know everything, and that I am going to have to be a continuous learner as the world continues to change. And it is also this mindset that the world is opened up to so much opportunity for collaboration, for community, for discussions like these that just weren't even possible when we were kids. And maybe that's why I get so excited about it, because I've seen life without it versus our students mm-hmm. who've always sort of lived in it. But yeah, it's a mindset, and it's skills, and it's a state of being. It's kind of a little bit of everything, which is so hard.
No, it's great. And I'll just say, you know, one of the things I really appreciate about the this interview and then about your work and reading the book is you do apply this great critical lens. And you're not a total technophile just saying like mm-hmm. technology will solve everything. Mm-hmm. But there's also this deep, like hopeful tone. Mm-hmm. It's not this like, oh, everything's awful and scary. And I think that was one of the things, like your excitement toward this, like, hey, actually digital ethics can be good and digital citizenship can be great and we can be critical of these things, but also like there can be something great and beautiful that we create in this process. And I just think that was part of what I really enjoyed about your work and then also just this conversation. So thank you so much.
Oh, I appreciate it. I really do. Thank you.
All right. Any final words that you would, I'll just, last piece would be, you know, any first steps that you would recommend to a teacher who says, I haven't really even given this much thought. What would you say as a final piece?
I would say, like, I mean, obviously buy the book, right? That's
yeah, go buy the book.
But, you know, I do have a website, drkmatson.com, where I share a ton of this kind of thinking on my blog and through some different classroom activities and things that I've posted. And actually, there is a whole component to the book that is on my website, so you can start to scope some of these things out before you even commit. I'd encourage you to take a look at the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma. Did you see that one mm-hmm. yet, John?
Yeah, I did.
It's going to put you in a place of uncomfort. Comfortability? No, that's not a word. You're going to feel uncomfortable. You're going to be a little discombobulated when you watch it. But I think it will open your eyes a little bit and allow you to say, oh yeah, this is why we have to have these conversations with students. Mm-hmm. I also highly recommend a couple of podcasts. If you're a podcast listener, I really like Rabbit Hole by New York Times, which is some of the psychology behind conspiracy theory rabbit holes and kind of how people end up in these spaces of just misinformation. And then I'm also a huge fan of Manoush Zomorodi's work. She has a book and a couple of really great podcasts. So I think those are just kind of easy places to start to dip your toes and not feel too overwhelmed by what's out there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. That is Dr. Kristen Mattson. She is a phenomenal thinker, and I really enjoyed this interview. Again, you can check out her latest book. It is called Ethics in a Digital World. She also has a really great book on digital citizenship. Both of her books are fantastic. You can find her at Dr. K. Mattson. Mattson is spelled M-A-T-T-S-O-N. So drkmattson.com. And again, just loved her insights that she had to offer us here. So again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.